From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Benny King celebrated his 60th birthday this week. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we feature an interview with him. In the late 50s, as a member of the Drifters, he sang on such hits as There Goes My Baby and Save the Last Dance for Me. Later, during his solo career, he recorded the hit he's best known for, Stand By Me. Also from the archives, an interview with Mac Rebinac, also known as Dr. John. Their singer, pianist, and songwriter has a new CD. TV critic David Bianculli reviews season premieres of two returning hit dramas, The Practice and Homicide. And film critic John Powers reviews Ronin, the new thriller starring Robert De Niro. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman.
Wind is blowing furiously. I've never seen anything quite like it. I'll tell you, it's both exhilarating and, just a bit frightening.
NPR's Wade Goodwin, who is following the path of Hurricane George in Key West, Florida. George has left a swath of death in his wake. At least 307 people died in Puerto Rico, Haiti, the Dominican Republic, and Cuba. The toll will rise. George is expected to rumble up Florida's western coast. But for now, weather forecasters fear for the people who have decided to ride it out in the Keys, where Wade Goodwin is stationed.
The rain's coming down horizontally. I mean, you have to get on the backside away from the direction the wind is blowing to be able to see out the window. If you try to look out a window toward the direction of the wind, you can't see anything because it's just the windows are just plastered with water. And when you get a side view, you can see that the wind is blowing the rain sideways. The power has gone out, which is very unfortunate, which means our air conditioning is gone. We can't watch television anymore and see exactly where the hurricane is. I can't listen to the radio in my room. When the toilets don't flush, the water won't run anymore. So we've really been reduced here to what we can see and hear out of the windows of this hotel.
This is Valerie Alker of member station WGCU of Fort Myers, Florida. After the storm exits Key West, it's expected to move up the west coast of Florida, brushing Collier, Lee, Charlotte, and Sarasota counties. The last update from the National Hurricane Center puts the storm somewhat more offshore than previously forecast, but still far too close for comfort. People are still taking the storm very seriously, boarding up and battening down. The winds are picking up, and in some places are accompanied by the sound of speakers blaring from emergency vehicles, telling people to leave and leave now. Many people have done just that.
This is Chad Pergram in Washington. Florida officials say about 1 million people were evacuated from Florida's east and west coasts. 80,000 people live in the Florida Keys, but it's estimated that about half of them did not leave despite a mandatory evacuation order. Federal Emergency Management Agency Director James Lee Witt.
The people that stayed in the Keys, we're still very concerned about them and we're preparing to be able to go in after the storm to provide assistance to them as quick as possible.
FEMA, along with the Red Cross and the military, are ready to ship food and bottled water as soon as George clears. They're also urging caution for those in the storm's path. Chad Pergram, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down more than 33 points at 7,968 in active trading. The Nasdaq Composite Index is off a point at 1719. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the world markets appear to be ending another highly volatile week lower amid worries about an investment fund bailout. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
Concerns over the Federal Reserve orchestrated rescue of long-term capital management continue to rock the financial markets today. Long-term capital, what's known as a hedge fund, is a type of investment vehicle that uses complicated financial instruments to make money for its mostly wealthy clients. However, the fund fell victim to the virulent virus that has now knocked the global economy for a loop. Even as some of the biggest banks on Wall Street have agreed to bail out the fund, stock markets from Tokyo to New York are clearly worried over when the next shoe will drop. What we have earned and what we spent, meanwhile, were both up last month. The government reports personal income rose 0.5%. Personal spending was up 0.6%. Sales of existing homes fell by 3.7% after July's big run-up. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
A team from the International Monetary Fund is meeting with Russian officials to discuss the next installment of a multi-billion-dollar loan package. There are no signs the IMF is ready to disburse the money yet. Russia says it needs the help desperately. The head of the Russian team says Moscow had hoped for the release of $4 billion by the end of the month. The IMF indicates it won't release the loan until it is certain Russia has adopted sound economic policy. Trade Representative Charlene Barshefsky says the U.S. trade deficit with Japan could reach an all-time record this year. She's warning American exports to Japan could get worse. Earlier this month, the Commerce Department reported the deficit with Japan was more than $36 billion, $5 billion more than it was at this time a year ago. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, where imaginations can run wild. Over 200 locations nationwide. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Benny King celebrated his 60th birthday this week. On this archive edition, we feature an interview with him. Benny King was the lead singer of The Drifters from 1958 to 1960 and can be heard on such hits as There Goes My Baby, This Magic Moment, and Save the Last Dance for Me. After leaving The Drifters, he went on to a successful solo career. His biggest hit was a song he co-wrote.
When the night has come and the land is dark and the moon is the only light we'll see, no, I won't be afraid. Oh, I won't be afraid. Just as long as you stand by me. So, darling, darling, stand by me. Oh, stand by me. Oh, stand by me.
That song is included on the CD The Very Best of Benny King, which was released earlier this year. I spoke with King in 1988. He told me that before he sang on stage or in the studio, he sang on the streets of Harlem.
I was born in Henderson, North Carolina, so I wasn't familiar with the street singing thing until I came to New York, which I was about 11 years old when my parents first moved to New York. And I heard about it, and then gradually, by being in the streets of Harlem, I walked around and, surely enough, bumped into different little guys singing and doo-wopping on the stoops and stuff like that. So I was more or less introduced to it when I first got to New York.
Did singing in a vocal group on the streets give you the same kind of security as belonging to a gang?
Yeah. Well, it gave me I would imagine a means of communicating with other people, because I was a very shy person when I first got to New York. I guess just the fear of New York itself made me that way. And it gave me a chance to meet nice people, nice guys to hang out with, kind of. And it was the alternative to other type of gangs. We had gangs during our time as well, but I fortunately for myself, I bumped into, I think, the right kind of people, you know.
Now, you also sang, before you started recording, you sang at Amateur Night at the Apollo Theater in Harlem. Did you all have matching suits in your group?
Yeah, we had, what did we have? We had pink jackets.
Oh, great.
I know, right? That's what I said. Pink jackets and black shirt and black trousers. I mean, it was a sight to behold there. Yeah.
Did you save up for the suits?
Yeah, we did. Well, what happened was that our parents gave us some money for it, because we were all, like, in school, you know, so our parents gave us money to go and buy these little uniform jackets and stuff, and we just found our own black trousers and stuff, yeah.
Did you have a choreographer also?
Not as such. What we had done, though, because I lived 116th Street and 8th Avenue, which was only maybe a few blocks from the Apollo itself, Apollo was 125th. So really I would go to the Apollo a lot. We all did, you know, and see all the other groups and just learn the things that they were doing and practice it in the streets and stuff like that. So we more or less had our own little routine, just taking it from different groups that was already professionals.
Which was the hottest group at the time that you really tried to emulate?
I would imagine like the Flamingos and the Spaniels, the Clovers, the Platters, people like that, you know. And like I say, we had a chance to go up to the Apollo and see him and, like, learn things from him.
That's great. Singer Benny King is my guest. Now, you sang with the Crowns.
Yeah.
The Five Crowns. And you sang bass before you started singing lead. Can your voice still go that low?
I think so. Yeah, Kent, I'm naturally a bass baritone. I guess that's what my voice tends to go very heavy. I'm naturally a bass baritone, so I can sing bass still, I think, yeah.
You went from bass singer with the Crowns to lead singer with the Drifters.
Yeah.
And before I ask you to tell us the story about how the Crowns became the new Drifters and how you got to sing lead, I want to play the first song that you recorded singing lead as the lead singer of the Drifters. And
okay.
this is There Goes My Baby. Benny King singing lead with the Drifters on There Goes My Baby. So tell us how the Crowns, who you sang with, became the Drifters.
Well, that's one of those strange stories, really. I joined the Crowns because the guy that was managing them by the name of Lover Patterson lived across the street from my father's restaurant. So he came in one day and asked me to join the Crowns. He brought him into the store and we rehearsed in the back of my father's restaurant and I became a member. And the Crowns were, I would imagine, a very good, like, vocal type group, semi-pro. And we opened up at the Apollo with Ray Charles and I think it was Faye Adams on the bill, and of course the Drifters were on the bill as well, and we were the opening act. During that week, we were approached by their manager, George Treadwell, and he had mentioned to us that he had been watching us and he thought we were a very good group and would we be interested in becoming a new set of Drifters.
He had just, fired Clyde McFadder, who had been the lead singer.
Yeah, well, what had happened in that, I think Clyde really wasn't in the group at that time. Clyde had more or less gone solo, but the other members were in the group. And he had, had problems with the group, or the group had problems with him. And they decided to just split company, and they did so, you know.
Right, so Clyde McFadder had left the group, and then the producer fired the rest of the Drifters. That's the way it worked.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And when the producer decided that your group would be the next Drifters, did they do anything different with you or tell you to do anything different for you to become Drifters?
Not really. I think that was a strange thing about the whole situation is that when we became a new set of Drifters, there weren't any instructions at all given to us. You know, we used to go on the road as the new set of Drifters before the record was released, and we were booed off the stage, and we had bottles thrown at us and chairs and the whole nine yards. So we weren't given any warning to what to do, how to act. We got uniforms, and I think we got a new station wagon or something like that. But that's the only thing that we received as far as becoming a new set of Drifters, as well as the fact that we had to fulfill the Drifters' recording contracts, and we weren't aware of that. You know, we were just four or five kids coming out of Harlem from a very, very amateurish background. Even during the time with the Five Crowns, we were just more or less, as I said before, semi-pro. So we didn't know about all the particulars that professionals would go through to more or less make a living in the business.
You got booed because the fans were expecting the other Drifters, and
yeah,
here you
exactly.
were with no explanation.
That's right, exactly. Well, it's like going to see the Four Tops, and all of a sudden the curtain opens, there's four guys about 17 years old. I mean, that's the kind of thing that you would face. Yeah.
Now, when you were telling us about the Crowns, you had sung bass with the Crowns, but you ended up singing lead when the Crowns became the Drifters.
Yeah.
How did you get to sing lead?
I wrote the song There Goes My Baby while we was on the road, and when I got back to New York, I showed it to Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller, who produced the date. And while we were in the studio, I was trying to show the lyrics to Charlie Thomas, who was the lead and did all the tenors to the songs. And for some strange reason, he couldn't get the feel of the song. And Jerry Wexler, who was involved with the date as well, came into the control room and said, look, Charlie's having trouble with this song. You sing it, you know. And I just went to the mic. I had an advantage over him because I had written the song anyway. So I went to the microphone and started singing, and I was stuck with Lee since then.
Stuck, huh?
Yeah, stuck, right?
A lot of the Drifters records had strings
on
it, and they really sound great, and I think they were probably the first or among the first R&B records to have strings on it. Did you go for that idea originally?
Oh, no, that had nothing to do with me. Again, like I said, I was just more or less along for the ride. I wasn't familiar with what went on in the studio. That was my very first time in a really professional studio when we went into the Atlantic Records studio as the Drifters. I didn't know that strings and kettle drums and cellos and all those pretty instruments weren't the norm for anyone that was going into the Atlantic studios. I didn't know that we were making history at that time. That was an idea brought up by Jerry Lieb and Mike Stoller, who was brave enough to make that move and change the whole musical history of rock and roll.
Well, I want to play another song that you recorded with the Drifters, and this is, of course, you're singing lead on it. This is a song that made it to number one both on the R&B charts and on the pop charts, which was a pretty big deal. Really.
Right. No, that was a great deal during that time, because in that time you have to allow for the fact that they weren't actually playing a lot of black records. And not only weren't they playing a lot of them, they weren't even thinking about crossing them over.
Let's hear your first version of it.
Okay.
You can dance every dance with the guy who gives you the eye to let him hold you tight. You can smile every smile for the man who held your hand neath the pale moonlight. But don't forget who's taking you home and in whose arms you're gonna be. So darling, say the last dance for me. Oh, I know that the music's fine, like sparkling wine. Go and have your fun. Laugh and sing. But while we're apart, don't give your heart to anyone. But don't forget who's taking you home and in whose arms you're gonna be. So darling, say the last dance for me. Baby, don't you know I love you so? Can't you feel it when we touch?
Well, that still sounds very terrific.
Thank you.
When you found out that you were going to be a lead singer, did that give a new push to your career? Had you been thinking that you weren't going to make it as a backup singer?
Not really. I didn't think about making it as a singer anyhow. I was doing what I was doing to enjoy my life. I didn't pursue a career in show business. I didn't know that you could have a career in show business. I thought that everybody was singing to have fun, not to earn a living, not to anticipate stardom. I still find it fascinating that so much money goes around in this business. I didn't actually start off to be a singer aiming at any particular careers or aiming at any particular spot in life. I just enjoyed music, which I still do very much.
We'll hear more of our 1988 interview with Benny King after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Sweeter than wine, softer than the summer night. Everything I want, I have. Whenever I hold you tight, this magic moment.
Singer Benny King is my guest. You know what I'd like to do? I want to ask you about how you started to perform solo. So why don't I play some of the record that launched your solo career?
Okay.
And this is Spanish Harlem.
It is a special one.
Benny King, would you explain how you left the Drifters and started singing solo?
Well, what happened in that is that once we got involved with all the recordings and we had all the hit records that we had once we started with the Drifters situation, we were on salary as the new set of Drifters, and we were making maybe $100 a week or somewhere in that neighborhood. And we were all more or less trying to make ends meet, because that $100 would have to keep us alive on the road and, of course, tried to send some money home. So we, in other words, to make a long story short, we had managerial problems. And I along with Charlie Thomas, Doc Green, and Ellsbury Harp, we had discussed trying to go to George Treadwell and ask for a raise. And this is a group with a number one record.
Mm-hmm.
And once we got to the office, we had set up a meeting, we got to the office to discuss this problem that we were having as far as salary. He told me, instead of me standing up to speak for the group, to speak for yourself, and I did so, and he fired me. he was great at firing people. And I walked out of the office, assuming that the other guys would follow, and they didn't. The only guy that followed me was the same one that came across the street to my father's restaurant and convinced me to join the Five Crowns, who was Lover Patterson. And it was his determination and his, feeling that I had something in my voice that should keep on. He insisted that I stayed in the business, and he was the one still I find very responsible for me still being here now. You know, I hold him very near and dear. He's long passed away for many years now, but to answer your story, he's the reason why I more or less stayed and started a solo career. The record that you just played recently was Spanish Harlem, was originally supposed to have been a Drifter record. Jerry Lieb and Mike Stoller, who at that time we had developed a very strong friendship as writers and producers and friends, and they're the ones that went to Atlantic and spoke to Ahmet Erdogan and asked him would he consider a Spanish Harlem being a Benny King record opposed to a Drifter record, and that's how I started a solo career with that record there, really.
Now, you also recorded Stand By Me as a solo record. Now, you wrote that record.
Yeah.
You wrote, and someone named Elmo Glick gets co-writing credits. Did he co-write it with you, or was that
Elmo
someone who just...
Glick was a silent partner for years. Elmo Glick is the pen name, I found this out maybe 4 or 5 years ago, of Jerry Lieb and Mike Stoller.
Oh, no.
Those were my ghostwriters, and I didn't know it for many, many years. So just go to show you, right? Yeah. But yeah, as I said earlier, you know, we were just kids out of Harlem with no knowledge at all about legalities and what should happen and what shouldn't happen in this business. And I'm only one out of hundreds and thousands of the artists that got those things happen to, you know. So
well, a lot of artists were deprived altogether of writing credits. So
gotcha.
So I guess in some respects,
I was lucky. I'm one of the lucky ones. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm one of the lucky ones.
I want to play one of your solo records that I think is one of the most dramatic-sounding pop songs I know, and this is I Who Have Nothing, and this is really high drama. I love this record. as everyone will hear, there are great pauses in this record, and when you come on, there's like timpani behind you.
Mm.
Were the pauses written in? Did you decide how long to pause? Did you know the timpani was going to come in with you?
Some of the things I would rehearse with Jerry Lieb and Mike Stoller, but that was just three guys around a piano. So most of the performing things that was done on the records was just the way I felt at that time. I'm not one of those regimented type recording persons where I know exactly what to do at each particular time in a song. I just close my eyes and go for it. Yeah.
Well, let's hear it. This is Benny King singing I Who Have Nothing.
I who have nothing, I who am no one, adore you and want your soul. I'm just a no one with nothing to give you but all. He
he buys you diamonds, bright, sparkling diamonds. But believe me, dear, when I say that he can give you the world, but he'll never love you the way I love you.
It breaks me up every time I hear that. Were you as emotionally involved in that recording as you sound?
Yes. I think what happened in that is that my manager and I, to make a long story short, my manager and I, at the time, his name is Al Weil. We were traveling over to Europe to get myself established over in the European market. And we got up one night while we were in Rome, and he had found this songwriter, and we went by this office. And this guy, he was Italian, of course, and he was speaking in Italian. He was playing Italian songs, but he played this one particular song, and my manager and I picked it up right then and there and said, this is a hit record. The guy was singing in Italian, had the same kind of deliverance and the same kind of feeling about the song. I didn't know what the words were saying, but I know the feeling was great. When I got home and we showed it to Jerry Lieber and Mike Stolen, they wrote the English lyrics to it. We knew that the song was great. I think that during that time when I was singing songs, I got very, very involved with it. The whole feel of the song. It's amazing when you grow older, your attitude changes, and you tend to not be as involved and not as, you don't throw your whole self into songs. I listened to myself when I was singing years ago, and I prefer my performance much more than I do today. And I did that with a feeling. When I was doing I Who Have Nothing, I tried to, at that time, compliment a song as a songwriter would have meant it to be.
Benny King recorded in 1988. He turned 60 this week. His CD, The Very Best of Benny King, was released earlier this year. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Dance with me. Oh, hold me closer, closer and closer, much closer, while the music plays. Much tighter while the rhythm sways. Put your lips to mine while the music blends. We're no longer strangers, now we are more than friends. So dance with me.
Dance with me closer, closer and closer. And maybe we'll be lovers when the music
coming up, TV critic David Bianculli reviews the season premieres of The Practice and Homicide. Film critic John Powers reviews the thriller Ronin. And we have an interview with Dr. John. He has a new CD.
I don't wanna know one thing about evil.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Tonight, Homicide: Life on the Street presents its seventh season premiere. And on Sunday, The Practice begins its third season. Our TV critic David Bianculli says these Emmy Award-winning shows are the best drama shows on television. Here's his preview.
Right now, the two best people writing and producing TV drama series are Tom Fontana, who did St. Elsewhere and currently runs Oz and Homicide, and David E. Kelly, who did Picket Fences and currently oversees Ally McBeal in The Practice. These two guys write most of the scripts themselves, explore characters and issues better than almost anyone in the business, and keep hitting home runs almost every time at bat. In a way, they're the Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa of series television, and they're just as exciting to watch. The difference is, with Fontana and Kelly, their season is just beginning. Tonight's season opener of Homicide: Life on the Street picks up a few months after the violent cliffhanger in May left off. The precinct house is all patched up after that squad room shootout, and so are most of the cops who got shot. Even Kyle Secor's bailiff is back at work, though he's a lot more philosophical since almost being killed. He's partnered now with Richard Belzer's Munch, who doesn't have much patience for Bayless's new mindset.
I died, you know, after I got shot.
You mean you had a near-death experience?
Oh, no, not near death. I actually died.
You mean you were going towards a bright light and all your ancestors were waving howdy?
No. It was more like I could feel all the, the different parts of me, the elements that make up my physical presence, water, air, earth. I could feel them breaking apart, dissipating. Yeah, becoming one with, the greatest force of energy in the universe.
Tim, this Zen detective thing is starting to really rub my rectum the wrong way.
Oh, I don't expect you to understand unless you understand, John.
That's exactly what I'm talking about.
What?
It's like being partnered with a fortune cookie.
This year, Homicide has to do without former regulars Andre Brower, who left the show and walked away with an Emmy, and Reed Diamond, whose hot-tempered character of Kellerman will be returning for at least one episode this fall. In their place are two new characters, Giancarlo Esposito as the estranged son of Yaphet Kotto's squad captain Giardello, and Michael Michelle is a gorgeous new detective who, as the season premiere begins, already is part of the squad and the focus of several colleagues' attentions. So much of this opening show is expository, though, that it seems to be setting the table more than serving a good meal. But if past performance is any indication, great things are just around the corner. Meanwhile, over on The Practice, Kelly comes up swinging and hitting homers right out of the box. His first two episodes this season are intense, unpredictable, and fun to watch, and take full advantage of Cameron Manheim, who just won an Emmy for her role as Eleanor, the aggressive, overweight attorney in the firm of Dylan McDermott's Bobby Donnell. In her first scene, she gets a frantic call from a client who, while driving in downtown Boston, has just hit a pedestrian and knocked him cold.
You've got to calm down, Alan. I can't even understand you.
Don't tell me to calm down. I hit him head on. He could be dead. He's lying in the street.
Have you called the police?
Yes, I called the police. What if I killed him? He's lying in the street.
You have just got to calm down, Alan.
Stop telling me to calm down!
Calm down! Now, is there somebody with the guy you hit?
Yeah, there's a crowd around him. He just darted out in front of me and... Oh, he seems to be moving now.
All right, all right.
Eleanor, I've been drinking, but I'm not drunk. God, I've got an open bottle of bourbon in my car. Should I throw it out?
Alan, I can't advise you to do that.
So what do I do? If he dies, I'll go to prison. I'm not drunk, I swear.
All right, how much have you had?
I don't know, maybe a third of a bottle. Maybe I should just drive off.
No, you cannot drive off. They will get you for leaving the scene.
So tell me what to do.
You have a bottle of bourbon right there?
Yes, it's right here. I've got to get rid of it.
All right, start drinking it.
What?
To calm your nerves, start drinking it and drink it out in the open. I will be right there.
Eleanor, what?
Drink the bourbon, Alan, now.
Her advice is surprising. And so is the identity of the accident victim, who turns out to be Bobby, her boss. Needless to say, he's not too thrilled about the ethics of her legal advice. Just as needless to say, my advice this weekend is to watch both The Practice and Homicide. As far as I'm concerned, this is when the TV season really starts.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Coming up, Dr. John. This is Fresh Air. Pianist, singer, and songwriter Mac Rebenack, better known as Dr. John, has a new CD. On this archive edition, we have an interview with him. Dr. John grew up in New Orleans and came of age when the city was one of the rock and roll capitals. In his teens, he worked as a session musician and producer with performers that epitomized the New Orleans sound, like Jimmy Clanton, Frankie Ford, and Huey Piano Smith. In the mid-60s, he left for Los Angeles, where he created the Dr. John persona. As Dr. John the Night Tripper, he led a production that combined voodoo, psychedelia, and old medicine shows. In the early 80s, he moved to New York and made his record debut as a solo rhythm and blues pianist. Dr. John has a new CD called Another Zone. Here's the title track. Back when Dr. John was a teenager, he played the New Orleans clubs with older musicians who promised his parents they'd look out for him. When I spoke with him in 1986, I asked him what the club scene was like.
Most of the clubs were fronts for something else. It was like, they were the bee drinkers and all, working prostitution out the backs of the clubs. They all had these motels connected to them. There was gambling going on, like in all these hidden rooms around the clubs. And it was all pretty, what was great about it was it left the club owners hired bands that played music that they liked. And there was a lot of freedom, so bands in those days did not have to play for the public. They played for club owners that enjoyed music. And what happened, there was a lot of clubs that had bebop music or different forms of music that was great for musicians who weren't under pressure to pack people in a club. Because these guys didn't even care if there was any people necessarily in the club, because that's not where their money was necessarily coming.
There are a lot of knife fights or gun fights at some of the rougher clubs that you played.
Oh, yeah. Some of the joints were real, typical bucket of blood joints. And some of the places that my family knew I was working, and some of them would have just pulled me out the whole scene. I mean, it was nights that guys would push me behind, these one-armed bandits, the little slot machines, and would use them like shields and shove me behind them when they'd see the guns come out and stuff. And, man, it was a night, that somebody got shot, stabbed, or whatever.
If the guns or the knives were coming out, were you supposed to keep playing?
Yes, we always were instructed to play loud and fast when trouble happened. That was kind of the rule of thumb. When trouble starts, you play loud and fast.
What was that supposed to accomplish?
Drown out the trouble.
Oh. Did it work?
Yeah.
So people wouldn't notice that much what was happening?
Yeah, so that the bouncer could clear the people out the place, and usually nobody was the wiser that somebody was murdered or whatever happened. It was usually not even noticed by the bulk of the paying people.
How did you start doing studio work?
Well, I hung at the studio, myself and James Booker and several of the musicians. As kids, we just literally hung at the studio hoping somebody would get sick or get hurt and that we'd get the sub for them. And, literally, we made you know, novenas to the saints that somebody would get ill, that we'd get a chance to play. And we'd wait. And occasionally somebody would be late and we'd get to play for a little bit. And usually they'd come and we'd get shooed out again. But slowly but surely we kind of got accepted into the clique. And it was like, I think, more to do with persistence than talent, you know.
I want to play a recording from your Gumbo album, and it's Those Lonely, Lonely Nights. What did you choose to do this song?
Well, I was looking for some Earl King songs. Earl was one of them. He and Huey Smith were two of the guys that encouraged me to keep on writing songs. And they were like the up-and-coming guys. Like Huey Smith was the young piano player coming up at that time, and Earl King was like called Little Guitar Slim, who was like the hero of the guitars at the time.
And why don't we hear it? You're featured on piano and vocals.
Right.
On this recording of Those Lonely, Lonely Nights from Dr. John MacRibbonack's album, Gumbo.
There's been some lonely, lonely nights. Oh, baby, yes, since you've been gone. Lay my head on my pillow. You used to say to me, you said that we would never part. Well, you know I love you, darling. Tell me, why did we have to part?
Yeah, no, you went from this background of playing a music rooted in jazz and blues and early rock and roll, and then you became one of the leading figures in psychedelic music, and you'd created this persona for yourself, the Dr. John persona. How was that created? Was it your idea to do that?
Well, I had always came up with album concepts. I would think of, like, well, this will be a project, and I would come up with, like, a lot of album projects so that if I had some work to do, that we'd have projects to fill in to do. And the Dr. John thing was, the idea was, at the time, there was no real shows that were out around. And the concept was to take all of the tricknology that I knew of show business from over the years, like throwing glitter to make the effect of magic, and using a lot of concepts that were easily and cheaply adaptable to show business and to make a show that would be real mystical in orientation for people. And it was a real, like, easy-to-do show. And all I had to do was to get a group of dancers, and I got all these people from New Orleans who were real familiar with that kind of music. And we did the album, and the show was geared to the snake dancers and all the regular voodoo shows of New Orleans. And unfortunately, when I first presented it, it was a little too authentic for the labels. They weren't quite ready for a guy biting a chicken's head off and stuff. So we modified the show down to a lot less authenticness, to more showbiz style, and took it on the road.
I want to play something from one of your early Dr. John the Night Tripper records, and this is from the Grigri album, and it's Grigri Gumbo Yaya. Do you want to say anything about when you started doing this song and how you'd get into it?
Well, this was the introduction song. Like, on the show, I would step on a button and have a big puff of smoke and say, they call me, and as the smoke cleared, it would look like I had just popped up. You know, it's an old magic trick.
And that was like the introduction song to our show. And this also was like introducing myself to the audience as who and what Dr. John is.
They call me Dr. John, known as the Night Tripper. Got my satchel of gris in my hand. They be tripping up and back down the bayou. I'm the last of the best, they call me the Gris-Gris Man. Got many clients, come from miles around, running down my prescription. I got medicine to cure all y'all's ills. I got remedies of every description. I got
Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-Gris-G
You were born Roman Catholic. What got you so interested in voodoo?
Well, it's a real heavy part of New Orleans scene. When I was coming up, it was like everybody I know, it's like you automatically, whether it was my grandmother or my grandfather, everybody did certain little gree-gree things. It was like the herbal remedies we took as a kid were strictly gree-gree things. And I don't think people, they look at the spells and the stuff, but that's a side of something, and it's a very small part of what gree-gree is about in Louisiana. And it's just part of the culture.
You were studying to be a priest in the Church of Voodoo and Witchcraft?
Well, what I actually did was legalize it. I chartered it so that the Reverend Mothers in New Orleans would not be busted for fortune-telling, for doing spells, and whatever they did prior to me having got a charter with the state of Louisiana. All these Reverend Mothers, who were some of the best people I ever knew, were getting busted on a regular basis for just going to hospitals and helping people, and it was ridiculous.
So you created the church to help legitimize their activities?
And it worked real well. It's like to this day they still can use this charter.
You know what I wanted to ask you about that I forgot to bring up earlier when you were talking about playing at the clubs? I had read somewhere that you were shot in the fingers, I think, when during a club date. What happened? What's the story with that?
Well, I was playing a gig in Jacksonville, Florida, and Ronnie Barron, who was singing with our band at the time, he was, like, really underage. He was, like, a couple of years younger than me. And his mother had told me, look, you look out for Ronnie. And I remembered how guys had looked out for me when I was first out there. Well, I went to get Ronnie for a gig. I walk in the room, and this guy's pistol whipping him over, like, a jealous lover scene. And I went to try to get the gun out the guy's hand. And in doing it, I got my finger over the barrel instead of the handle of the gun. And as I hit the guy's hand on a rock to get the gun out of his hand, went off and blew the tip of my finger off. And I was fortunate they were able to sew the tip back on, but it's like affected me from being a guitar player. And it really took a toll. I really feel a lot of the contribution of me getting into drugs was connected with this incident, that I was very depressed about not being able to follow my career as a guitarist. And even though I went into playing keyboards and other things that worked out later, there was a long space of time when I was very, like, I had just geared my life to being a guitar player, and all of a sudden that was, like, gone, and it really messed my whole head up.
Our interview with Dr. John was recorded in 1986. He has a new CD called Another Zone. Let's hear him at the piano in a piece he dedicated to the great New Orleans pianist, his mentor, Professor Longhair. This is from an earlier CD called Dr. John Plays Mack Rebinac. Coming up, film critic John Powers reviews Ronin. This is Fresh Air. Ronin is a new action thriller starring Robert De Niro. It's directed by Hollywood veteran John Frankenheimer. Our film critic John Powers has a review.
In Hollywood's golden days, American movies didn't travel all that much. If a story took place in Budapest, a fake Hungarian street would be built on a backlot somewhere in Culver City. But in the 50s and 60s, Hollywood began to use exotic locations as a selling point, sending Audrey Hepburn off to fall in love in Rome, or James Bond to kill people in the Caribbean. You got a little travelogue along with the story. All that changed again in the 70s, when the generation of Coppola, Altman, and Scorsese shifted filmmakers' perceptions of how you use a location. Suddenly it was considered hokey and embarrassing to fill your movie with tourist stuff. And ever since, the movies have rarely shown us the world with the same kind of glamorous sheen. One of the pleasures of the new thriller Ronin is that it does. The movie begins on the shadowy streets of Montmartre, dips south to the majestic hotel in Cannes and the cobblestone back streets of Old Nice, jets back up to the photographic ruins at Arles, and winds up at a packed ice-capade show in Paris. It's an unabashed throwback to 60s filmmaking. Robert De Niro stars as Sam, a grizzled ex-CIA operative who's now working freelance. He gets hired by an Irish woman named Deirdre, played by the beamingly untalented Natasha McElhone. Sam's to be the strategist for a heist involving the familiar menagerie of experts, an American driver, a British weapons advisor, a German electronics expert, and a French operations guy, played by Jean Reno. Their mission is to steal a briefcase from a well-armed cohort of crooks. Naturally, this mission proves trickier than advertised. The Russian mafia and an IRA crazy are also after the case, which is what the skeptical Sam anticipated all along. That's why, early on, he demands a bigger payday than originally promised.
What's in the case?
That information isn't necessary.
Is it heavy? Is it explosive? Is it chained to some unlucky bloke's wrist? We're going to have to chop it off?
All right. What is it? But I'm not under any obligation to let you know.
If you are not, then the price has got to go up. I'll get you the case, but the price has got to go up. If it's going to be amateur night, I want $100,000. I want it up front. I want it in a bank account. I want another $100,000 when you get the case.
Ronin takes its title from the Japanese legend of the 47 Ronin, dishonored samurai who roamed the countryside after the death of their master. Sam and his cronies are the modern equivalent, leftovers of the Cold War, each with mysterious pasts, secret wounds, private agendas. And for the opening hour, the movie has an enjoyably jaded tone, redolent of bitter coffee, cheap cigarette smoke, and the enduring professionalism of men who long ago abandoned their ideals. Like Anthony Hopkins, De Niro is developing a knack for playing pulp characters. His personal force makes them seem bigger than life. He gives Sam the understated charisma you find in the films by the great French director Jean-Pierre Melville, for whom world-weary professionalism was a state of existential being. De Niro plays beautifully off sad-eyed Jean Reno, whose elongated face makes him look like an El Greco version of Sylvester Stallone. Just as the French operative keeps deferring to the more experienced Sam, so Reno clearly defers to De Niro, whose talent far outstrips his own. In the second hour, unfortunately, the movie loses any pretense at seriousness and turns into a series of set pieces, mainly terrific car chases, a low-tech form of excitement that reinforces the movie's 60s feeling. This old-fashioned air is hardly surprising, for Ronan was directed by 68-year-old John Frankenheimer, whose heyday came in the Kennedy-Johnson years, when he made Birdman of Alcatraz, 7 Days in May, Seconds, and his one enduring masterpiece, The Manchurian Candidate. For the last 20 years, most people have thought he was washed up. But Frankenheimer was confident that he still had it. He kept making movies and TV shows, usually lousy ones, keeping his career alive by selling his professionalism to people who didn't ask for anything more. Ronan is his best and most enjoyable film in the last quarter century, and it's easy to see why. John Frankenheimer knows all about warriors who've lost their glory and are looking for ways to regain their honor.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Roberta Shurrock and Kathy Wolf. Dorothy Therabee is our administrative assistant. Bob Purdick is our engineer. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.